Goldman Sachs out this morning saying that a tapering announcement could happen as soon as November. So not at the conference, but maybe indications about what's going to happen. Aneta Markauskas is with us now, Jefferies chief financial economist. And Aneta, in your note previewing the conference, you say no fireworks. So what do you think is happening on the taper front? And do you think that, how important do you think the timing is of when it begins?
You know, whether it depends, whether it begins in November, December, I don't think that makes a big difference. I think most of it is already in the price. My base case is November. So I would agree with that forecast you just cited this earlier. You know, the timing of this Jackson Hole conference is certainly interesting because while we've seen the progress on the labor market that I think the Fed wanted to see, we finally are, you know, averaging about 950,000 jobs per month, at least in the last 2 months. So the labor market certainly seems to be moving in the right direction, but we're obviously experiencing this temporary setback in terms of growth momentum, right on the back of all the July data that disappointed, and now obviously the Delta variant potentially putting a dent in service activity here in August and possibly into September. But, you know, so I would say it makes it difficult for the Fed to signal anything and to commit to any particular taper timeline at this point. But I think they do have to acknowledge that we have made further progress on those taper goals. And by the way, growth momentum is not part of the taper test. So it's just really more about the optics and the uncertainty that we're facing. I think it's a very kind of short-term pocket of uncertainty. And, you know, things will feel very differently probably by October and certainly by November if the Delta peak is behind us.
And, you know, Aneta, I guess we'll have this conversation through this week, but I do wonder if, speaking of the optics of having to make the conference virtual sort of puts into starker relief of a sort where we're at in the recovery. And if maybe there were plans, and I don't really think Jay Powell is the kind of guy who's going to change his plans for this sort of speech overnight. But if there were plans to signal an earlier taper, it certainly gets more difficult when you've just had to kind of bring the conference back to a 2020 type setting, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he's been writing this speech for weeks now, so I doubt that it, you know, underwent any major revisions because of the conference going remotely. I mean, just think about last year. They were in a fully remote setting and they were able to communicate a framework change. So I don't think it's a massive deal, you know, but you're right. The optics are certainly a little bit tricky. I think this is just kind of symptomatic of what we're seeing in the business community more broadly. A lot of conferences getting canceled. That's obviously going to, again, put a dent in service activity in terms of flights and hotels. So I think that's certainly, you know, very true. I do want to highlight, though, that, you know, that it's the duration of this uncertainty that's really we should be questioning, right? Because if the CDC projections are correct, and if, in fact, we are pretty much close to peaking in terms of Delta cases in the South, and if they peak in the Northeast, say, 4 or 5 weeks from now, you know, those optics can change very, very quickly. And I think by the November FOMC meeting, you know, the narrative out there and sort of the confidence about the recovery, the continued recovery will be much stronger. So absolutely, optics are difficult. It's a setback. But I think it, you know, the chances are that it will be relatively short lived.
How severe is this growth slowdown, Aneta? I was just reading your note this morning, and you show a lot of interesting charts on restaurant bookings. Those have been under pressure in recent weeks. Hotel rates, hotel bookings also under pressure. Just in terms of, I guess, GDP this quarter, what are you looking for?
Yeah, so I think it's sort of realistic to look for roughly 3% growth, 3 to 4% range. That's certainly down from, you know, where we were tracking or sort of what we were assuming going into the quarter, which was closer to 6 to 7%. So again, definitely a loss of momentum. I would say what we've seen in monthly data and even in real-time data that you showed there is basically a stall in activity. We're certainly not contracting. It's really just kind of a stall driven by certain sectors, those that are obviously more sensitive to the Delta variant. And even there, it's been very localized. So really, the bulk of the drug has so far come, you know, from the South. So again, I would characterize it as a loss of momentum. We're certainly not contracting. And I do still think that, you know, there's a good chance we get a lot of it back in the fourth quarter and in early 2022. I mean, the fundamentals really have not changed. We're still looking at the healthiest household balance sheets in decades, lowest inventories pretty much on record, CapEx intentions very, very strong. So none of that has changed. Again, this is really just another delay in this recovery cycle that I think still has pretty long legs.
So, Annetta, let's assume that this is happening, right, that we're having a delay of that resumption of growth or hotter growth. Let's assume the Fed does announce a taper, whether it's November, December, whenever it is. Given all that, will there be another so-called taper tantrum, do you think, in the markets?
I really doubt it. I mean, what's so different this time from 2013 that, you know, 2013, the Fed really just dropped the bomb and they went from not even talking about taper to saying, hey, we're going to taper here pretty soon. Obviously, very, very different communication strategy this time around. And even, you know, and even sort of from a few months ago all the way up to the actual taper announcement, I think they're going to communicate it very incrementally. They added this language in the statement in July, you know, sort of acknowledging we've made progress. I think the next iteration will sort of be upgrading that to further progress and then eventually to substantial further progress. So by sort of, you know, communicating in such an incremental fashion, I think they've taken pretty much all of the surprise element out of it. So, you know, everybody knows they're going to taper. The only debate is, you know, is it November, December, or maybe January? Again, I don't think that makes a huge difference in terms of, you know, where the rates market's trading. I think the significance of the taper announcement to me is that it really kind of gets that out of the way and allows the market to focus on the next step, which is the timing of liftoff. And more importantly, what actually happens post liftoff and just how quickly do they tighten from there on? Because that's, I think, where the curve is most, you know, quote unquote, mispriced at the moment.
Let's stay on the markets here. Bring in Joanne Feeney, partner and portfolio manager at Advisors Capital Management, for more on her market outlook. Joanne, thanks for jumping on this morning. I want to start with something you sent over in our notes about the biggest risks. You know, is it COVID? Is it inflation, China, rates? Or is it staying out of the market? And I would ask, you know, are you still talking to folks who are relatively underinvested, kind of worried for the next shoe to drop, even with the S&P, you know, as we saw last week, having officially doubled, you know, from that COVID low?
Love that you landed on that last risk of staying out of the market. I think that is what a lot of folks are afraid of. We do hear that from clients who have some cash on the sidelines and are wondering if this is the right time to bring it in. Those other risks are not to be ignored, though, either. I mean, clearly the Delta variant is causing havoc, not just here in the United States, but, you know, the report out of Malaysia this morning, how that's potentially going to interfere further with the semiconductor final packaging, and that's going to further interfere with our supply chains. You know, inflation, I think we're getting some signals that that's coming back down, right, as we see some of those shortages ease. We still have to worry about wages going up, though, potentially causing a longer-term problem. And then obviously we have the Fed meeting in Jackson Hole later this week, and folks are really on the edges of their seats waiting to see what Chairman Powell is going to say. China remains an issue with their regulatory crackdowns, but we've seen this before out of China, and we've also seen the big, important growth driver companies out of China bounce back from prior regulatory crackdowns. So, you know, that potentially is an area for folks to start to invest in. People need to remember at this point that the economic recovery is really in its early innings and that there's a lot more places to go to capture that in your stock portfolio. So this would be a bad time, I think, to be out of the market so long as you're selective about finding companies with good, attractive valuations and being careful not to just own the really popular stocks where the valuations have gotten a little bit steep.
Joanne, yesterday I talked with DoubleLine's founder, Jeffrey Gundlach, about potential risks to the market from a Fed taper. Take a listen to what he said. I'd love to get your reaction on the back end.
Certainly would be negative for the stock market. As I pointed out, the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet goes in lockstep with the capitalization of the S&P 500. And when we saw when they tried to taper in 2018, the stock market had a sort of a mini crash, actually went into a very compressed bear market in the fourth quarter of 2018. And it forced the Fed to completely change their activity.
Joanne, do you see Do you see a Fed taper as destabilizing to equities?
You know, maybe short-term volatility, but this is a really different situation than the previous tapers that people have focused on. You know, Gundlach was focused on the 2018 comment that Powell made about, you know, interest rates are far from normal. But earlier than that, right in 2013, 2015, we also saw some concerns about Fed tapering. Clearly, the balance sheet is very large. But as an economist, I can tell you that we're in a really different situation now than we were in either of those times. Number one, we're at the beginning of an economic recovery. And it's really in the hands of firms to continue to invest, which they are doing, and consumers to continue to bounce back in terms of their spending, not just on services, but also on different kinds of goods. And third, global recovery is just barely getting underway. Delta is a bigger problem for them, and they're struggling with it. But as we go through the quarters and the years coming up, we're going to see global demand recover and supply. So we're in a really different situation fundamentally in terms of production. And that means that we can see sales and profits continue to expand for companies, really based just in fundamentals. The Fed was really critical, right, in providing the liquidity during the depths of the crisis. Their continuing accommodation is no longer as necessary. So, you know, when they begin to cut back on those bond purchases, there's still a lot of liquidity in the system. They don't need to be adding more. And so I don't expect the same kind of disruption to the stock market that we've had in the past, at least not in a long-term way. People are obviously on the edge of their seats worrying about, you know, what's going to happen and when they're going to start to taper. But again, fundamentally, if we look at the production side of the economy, labor is going to come more back to the market after Labor Day when kids are back in school, when more folks are vaccinated, right, when those unemployment benefits run out. So we have a lot of good fundamentals in place for continued economic growth. And so I think that's what makes this situation really different from previous concerns about tapering back in the, you know, mid to, you know, 2015 and 2018.
So, Joanna, it's Julie here. So it's one thing to say that, you know, we are at the beginning of this economic recovery. It's another to bet on companies that are reliant on people being out and about right now. And I say that because, oof, Six Flags caught my eye in your list of stock picks. And I just wonder, you know, at a time when we are seeing the numbers of people who are out and about in gathering places like that go down a little bit. You know, Disney seems to be a little bit resistant to that, but where do you think Six Flags falls?
Yeah, well, the advantage that Six Flags does has over, you know, say restaurants or airlines or, you know, brick and mortar, at least during this COVID spike, right, is that they are outdoors, right? And even though we have seen outbreaks and we've seen Disney pull back, for example, on some attendance numbers, that outdoor nature of their business does give them an advantage. And we should in this country, right, see the COVID hit its peak sometime in the next few weeks, according to the experts. And so, you know, we should see their earnings grow over time. So it's not a bad time to buy something like Six Flags because, you know, in some ways things are as bad as they're going to get in terms of, you know, people being concerned about the pandemic. And so we should actually see them recover nicely. And their outdoor nature obviously gives them a big leg up over, you know, some of the indoor service activities where we are seeing people pull back. They're not going to movie theaters as much, for example. They're not traveling as much. So there is some advantage that Six Flags has there. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why we think this is a good time to get into that stock. We've owned it for a while since sort of late last year. We decided to get into that reopening activity early. And it's worked out pretty well for our clients. But we do think there's more room for this company to go up and to see their earnings grow, you know, as people get back out there.
So Karen Parkhill is back with us. She is the Medtronic CFO, as well as our Anjali Kamlani, who covers healthcare for us. Karen, thanks for being here. And it seems as though elective surgeries really was something that helped give you guys a lift in the quarter. Talk to me about how much that contributed to your numbers, because, of course, many of your devices are used in necessary operations and procedures as well.
Thanks, Julie. Yes, we had a really good, strong quarter, and it was a great start to our fiscal year. We saw continued progression throughout the quarter, each month getting better, including July better than June. And that was driven by the strength of procedures coming back, as well as the strength of our new product introductions that we had across many of our businesses. And we continued to gain share across many of our businesses, including our three largest, which are cardiac rhythm management that you mentioned, our spine business, and our surgical instrumentation business.
Karen, Anjali here. I wanted to know about how the company sees this sort of rise in interest, at least, with remote monitoring devices and generally medical devices. I know there's been a shift over the years from sort of inpatient to outpatient surgeries, and now it seems like the next step is forming thanks to the pandemic. Do you feel like the company is sort of positioned right and looking either through M&A or its own pipeline to sort of fit the bill?
Thanks, Anjali. We are very excited about what remote monitoring can do for our patients today and going forward, and we are investing heavily in that space. If you think about remote monitoring, particularly during the pandemic, we quickly instituted remote monitoring for our ventilators during the pandemic, and we're able to monitor those patients, not necessarily inside the room with the patient, but outside quite heavily. We also have insertable cardiac diagnostic monitors now that with our Link devices that can monitor the heartbeats and heart issues with patients 24/7. So we're really excited about what that can do for patients going forward.
And Karen, we're looking at the breakdown of revenue by the different units. I also want to talk about the breakdown of domestic versus international. You get just over half of your revenue, or at least you did this quarter, from the United States. As we see how COVID has been spreading around the globe at different times, what has that meant for the sort of cadence of your revenue growth around the globe?
Yeah, thanks, Julie. In terms of U.S. revenue, yes, it is over half of our revenue comes from the United States. And we are seeing the impact of the Delta variant currently right now. We saw it actually in the last couple of weeks of July, which was the end of our first quarter. And we're seeing that continue into August. You know, we're monitoring it closely, and we believe that the impact that this variant will have will be short-lived. We do believe that we'll recover quite quickly. We expect the infection rate to probably peak around August, the end of August or early September. And the ICU capacity and hospital bed capacity to get better a few weeks after that infection peak. And so we expect by the tail end of our second quarter, clearly improvement in procedure levels, and the back half of our fiscal year to be stronger than the first.
And Karen, if you could give me a little bit more color on that, because what I imagine is as we see ICUs, as you said, quite busy, particularly not just around the globe in certain places, but here in the U.S., particularly in the Southeast, I would imagine that you are seeing the effect that you saw at one time in the entire United States, people pushing off certain procedures. From what you saw then and a catch up, is that what you expect to see again? And is that indeed what happened? In other words, did most of the procedures that people put off, did they end up starting to try to do them during the reprieve that we had in the spring going into the summer?
Yes, yes, indeed, we did see a catch up in the prior waves of COVID from that procedure volume. And we hope and expect that to happen here. And with each wave of COVID, the time frame between impact and catch up has shortened because hospitals are better equipped to deal with patients, because vaccination rates have increased across this country and across the world. And because I think patients are learning to deal with COVID and get back into the hospital to have those important procedures that they need.
Karen, I want to pivot a little bit to what's going on in D.C. There's a lot of conversation about generally the cost of healthcare. And in my conversation with hospital CEOs over the years, medical devices have come among the list of the most expensive things that they need to account for. I'm curious on your thoughts on this and whether or not you see sort of the industry needing to address this in any way, or have you had conversations, you know, among the C-suite about this?
You know, we clearly focus on pricing our products very appropriately. And in fact, it's embedded in our mission that our mission says that we need to make a fair profit to continue in our innovation and to meet our obligations. It doesn't say to maximize profit, it says to make a fair profit. And when we think about the prices of our devices, these are important life-saving devices that help improve outcomes. And with those improvements in outcomes, we are focused on driving the total cost of healthcare down because our devices do just that. They reduce infection rates in certain cases, they reduce other complications, and as a result, the total cost of healthcare comes down because of our devices.
And Karen, something else I noticed in your forecast from this morning, and I apologize because in prepping for the show, I didn't have a chance to listen to the call, so perhaps this was addressed. You guys raised the lower end of your earnings per share forecast. You didn't raise your revenue forecast for the full year. And so I'm wondering where that upside is coming from, especially, and I know that healthcare costs for input costs for you guys, as well as prices, have been rising pretty steadily even before the pandemic. The rest of the world is sort of catching up at this point. But I am curious where that lever came from that allowed you to raise that EPS forecast without raising the revenue forecast.
Yeah. So we had a really strong first quarter where we beat consensus on the bottom line by 9 cents. And that gave us confidence to increase the lower end of our EPS range for guidance for the full year. You know, we're still really confident in our ability to deliver 9% plus or minus growth for the full year. We do believe that we're being impacted this quarter, obviously, from the Delta variant of COVID. And it's still really early in our fiscal year. We just finished one quarter. So it'd be unusual for us to raise our revenue guidance after one quarter. And you put the Delta variant on top of that. You know, that's why we didn't raise. But we also said that our guidance did assume that we don't necessarily make back all of the procedures that we might lose during Delta variant. We certainly hope that we do, and past experience would show that we do. But that just shows you that we're taking a really conservative stance with our revenue guidance of 9+% 9+ or -% for the year.
Got it. Copy that. Well, let's hope that the recovery from that Delta variant will indeed be as compressed as you said, and we're all hoping for. Karen Parkhill, good to catch up with you again, Medtronic CFO, and our Anjali Kamlani. Thanks, Karen. Be well.
All right, welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live on this Tuesday morning. We've talked a lot about the outlook for the real estate space, particularly the single family home space, but let's broaden out and think about the entire sector as a space and, you know, return to office, multifamily. You've got all kinds of other distribution warehouses fitting in there. Joining us now to talk about all of this is Rich Anderson, senior REIT analyst over at SMBC Nikko Securities America. Rich, thanks so much for jumping on this morning. I want to start with the return to office and how you guys are thinking about the way office space is going to be used. Because as you know highlight in your notes to us, we saw a major transition in the office 15 or 20 years ago, going from cubicles to a more open floor plan. As you talk to folks and think through that, what does that physical kind of use of the space look like? And does it lead to companies needing less space, or are those footprints, in your view, kind of going to remain the same?
It's a great question, and thanks for having me. You know, the office space over the past 20 plus years has always been on a sort of evolutionary path. As you mentioned, cubicles to open floor plans, and to the some extent, now we're going to have, you know, some element of hybrid office, you know, in the aftermath of the pandemic. It is a question, will that mean less or more demand for office space? And that's kind of a TBD. But the way we're thinking about it is, you know, you need social distancing within the four walls of office. So that might offset some of the lack of demand. But I think the business will trade on the recovery of office, the increased census of occupied space as we, you know, kind of navigate this wave of the Delta variant. And I don't think that the landing spot of office is going to be wildly dismantled versus pre-pandemic. I think it'll look a fair amount like it used to, with some element of hybrid that'll be built into it that kind of resembles like a WeWork execution with hot desks and things like that. So it'll be interesting, evolutionary, and the answer won't be the question won't be answered for many years from now.
Rich, it's Julie here. It seems impossible, though, to imagine that there won't be less of it, right? I mean, the sort of at one point in the pandemic, there was talk about office space migrating to the suburbs just as people had. But we're reporting on companies every day that are going hybrid in some measure for some portion of their workforce. So just looking at that anecdata, for lack of a better word, seems impossible to think that there just won't be less office space overall that is needed.
Right. So over the years, the office business in terms of density went from about 250 square feet per employee to about 150 square feet per employee. And so that would naturally mean less demand for office. And yet, magically, that didn't really happen. And so, you know, you have different sort of executions about how office space is utilized, and it's maybe easy to imagine less demand for space. And you know, that might be true to some degree 5 years from now. But I don't think, you know, as a stock analyst, I'm so worried about what the landing point is of office demand, you know, and the ideas about, you know, what might be imagined today. I think there is going to be recovery in the utilization of space today. There will be some element of hybrid office, and that's, you know, that's something that we'll figure out as we go. And if we don't get all the way back to, you know, full demand pre-pandemic, perhaps a conversation for another day. As from the REIT's perspective, it's about the recovery right now, and it's about getting people back into the office. It's an interesting thing. Packed stadiums, packed restaurants, and yet no one's going to the office. What a great social world for all of us these days, but I don't think that's very sustainable. So I say, you know, we will be back in the office sooner rather than later, to a degree more than what people are imagining at this moment.
Rich, we very easily could get a Fed taper soon that goes on to push interest rates higher. How will that impact the fundamentals of these highly leveraged REIT companies?
Well, I wouldn't call them highly leveraged REIT companies. In fact, I'd call the REITs, you know, very, you know, the balance sheets to be quite strong. The concern about interest rates is more, in my mind, about the dividend component of the REIT vehicle. And so as interest rates rise, the value of the dividend yield goes down. And so there will be, if that were to happen, some type of hiccup. Depending on the asset class, there are asset classes like multifamily that rely less on the dividend yield and more on a total return story, whereas other asset classes like healthcare and net lease are very much income vehicles and less about a total return sort of story about reinvesting into the businesses. And so back in 2013, when we had the taper tantrum, the healthcare REITs and the net lease REITs wildly underperformed and others did not do so badly. I would expect a similar reaction this time around, to the extent, it, as you described, something like that happens.
And Rich, you touched on multifamily. And the last time you were on with us last year, you talked about how you thought multifamily would recover. It did end up recovering. So what happens now for multifamily?
You know, that it's funny, the hybrid office model is really a great thing for multifamily. And you're right, we were down 30-40% last year when we spoke, and we were pushing multifamily, and those stocks are up this year, you know, 40+%. So the calls work. The question is what kind of sustainability do we have in that call? And we think it's going to continue. One reason is because of hybrid office. Now no longer you can't move from New York to Nebraska and still have a job. You got to be close to the office if a hybrid model is intact, so that you know, that means people moving back closer into the cities, and that should be good for the multifamily business. Likewise, universities opening back up also, you know, disproportionately benefiting gateway markets. And so I think the hybrid office model, however it works out for the office business longer term, we shall see. It's certainly a good thing for the multifamily business.
All right, we'll leave it there. Rich Anderson, senior analyst with SMBC Nikko Securities. Rich, appreciate the time this morning.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. I'm Julia LaRoche, filling in for Echiko Fujita. As of August 19th, more than 4.59 million children have tested positive for the COVID-19 virus since the onset of the pandemic, and over 180,000 cases were added just in the past week, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Here to discuss more is Dr. Mona Amin, a board-certified pediatrician. Dr. Amin, we were having a conversation just about this virus and protecting kids. And I know there are a lot of parents out there that have a lot of concerns. Would love for you in your position as a pediatrician to kind of shed some light on the situation.
Thank you so much for having me. I am a pediatrician. I'm also a mom of a toddler who is 20 months in daycare. So we are living COVID, breathing COVID. It is a tough time for parents. One, because we're 18 months into this and we thought that maybe we would be on an upward swing, and we're actually in the second biggest wave for children. Like you said, 180,000 children in the last week have tested positive. The highest we've ever seen for children has been 211,000. That was back in January. So this Delta variant is changing the game. I want to really, really empathize with all the parents out there who are concerned. Some of the biggest things that we can do to protect our children are things that we should have been doing, which is vaccinating anyone who's eligible and masking anyone who is able to be masked. These are two surefire ways of helping protect our children who are too young to mask or maybe too young to get a vaccine.
That's a good point. I mean, obviously, if they can't get the vaccine, this is, you know, it's on us, everyone who's eligible to do it, to do so. When we talk about, you know, where we're at in vaccinations here in the U.S. and kind of what parents could be doing outside of keeping their kids home and not traveling anywhere, trying to be safe around their kids, there's not much else I think that they can do. And that's kind of part of the frustration here. But what's the advice to parents who are thinking about sending kids back into schools, particularly those ones where, you know, the masks might not be worn, you know, around this? And, you know, we're starting to hear anecdotally some people out there talking about, you know, something similar to chickenpox parties and trying to get Delta ahead of perhaps, you know, a worse variant that could be more dangerous for children if that were to emerge. You know, what's kind of the advice there for anything parents can do?
I think the biggest things we have to remember is risk reduction. We know that this virus is around. It's really nearly impossible to completely avoid a virus, right? It's invisible. We can't completely do that. So we talk about risk reduction. This means, who are we surrounding our children with? What is your level of comfortability? I know you mentioned that people want to do chicken pox party, you know, something very equivalent. The concern about that is we still don't know who is considered high risk for hospitalizations. Children are getting hospitalized at higher rates than we've ever seen. And yes, we do see that most children who are hospitalized are children of unvaccinated parents. But as this Delta variant surges, we are also seeing children of vaccinated parents get admitted for hospitalization for COVID. So with doing chickenpox type parties, the risk there is that you don't know if your child is going to get hospitalized. You don't know if your child is going to get a complication from COVID because this is sort of a new virus. So we want to really focus on risk reduction. And what that means is doing what we can in our control. I'm a mom too. My husband is also a physician. We really look at, well, what can we do? Who are we surrounding ourselves with in terms of play dates, maybe doing something outdoor? Your question about masking in schools. This is the best thing we can do for our children who are not vaccinated. And I don't think it's an automatic keep your child home if there's no masking rule, but there has to be other precautions in place. Are they doing distancing? Put your child in a mask. If your child is high risk for complications, maybe, you know, asthma, or talk to your child's clinician if you're unsure, think about maybe homeschooling them or having distance learning until they do require a masking requirement or until Delta settles down a bit.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Dr. Amin. Do you think pediatricians will end up prescribing vaccines for kids under the age of 12?
This is a great question. And once the approval came in for 16 plus, there was a lot of questions on if we're able to do off-label prescriptions for children under that age. I think it's a conversation that needs to be had with the child's pediatrician. The biggest issue is we still don't know the dosing recommendation for children under 12. That's why they're still in clinical trial. We don't know if it's going to be the same dosing as adults, and likely it's going to be a little bit less, especially if we're going into that age, you know, 5-year-old, 6-year-old age group. So I really think it's more of that conversation. If a child is 11 and a half, high risk, approaching 12, maybe the size of a 12-year-old or, you know, tall, then maybe it's a consideration of prescribing it as off-label use. But I don't want parents to rush. I don't want parents to lie to get the vaccine, because there is a checks and balances to make sure that are we giving the right dosing. And we would hate to give the wrong dosing if the benefit doesn't outweigh the risk.
And doctor, I mean, the other thing that stands out here too for me is the point that you made there around breakthrough transmissions. And you know, parents might be vaccinated and think they're good to go. We know we're increasingly hearing about breakthrough transmissions and what that could mean for children as well, who are not vaccinated, can't be under the current age restrictions. So I mean, when you look at that and you weigh kind of how bad things could get as we move farther and farther along in the school year. I mean, talk to me about pediatricians right now, maybe bracing for a terrible peak that we saw similar to adults last year, given there are no protections there.
It's tough. You know, we're a little worried. We're worried not so much with the, you know, people talk about the death rate. They talk about mortality in children. We're not worried about the mortality rate, although those are lives lost that we don't want to lose, which is why we talk about masking and vaccine and precautions, right? But it's also about the hospitalizations, children being pulled away from school because they get COVID, they get hospitalized, hospital bills, everything that comes with being hospitalized as a child that we're trying to avoid. We know that we're not able to completely avoid this, right? We know this with the flu, we know this with RSV, but we have a vaccine, we have masking protocols that can really help reduce the risk. So to answer your question, we don't know what the next few months are going to look like. We are taking precaution with breakthrough infections, with unvaccinated individuals. We are still learning so much about transmission because Delta is changing the ballgame a little bit. You know, it is highly transmissible compared to the original strain. Children are getting it more because of the fact that it's highly transmissible. So we do the best that we can with risk reduction, with masking, with vaccination, with maybe weighing benefit and risk with every social experience that we take our unvaccinated children into.
And after yesterday, we saw New Jersey requiring vaccination or testing protocols similar to what President Biden's called for now for teachers in schools in that state. We'll see what happens in other states as well. But Dr. Mona Amin from Florida, board-certified pediatrician, appreciate you coming on here to chat with us today. Be well.
Welcome back to the Yahoo Finance Lab. I'm Julia LaRoche, filling in for Akiko Fujita. Well, we've been having this big conversation around hybrid work, the future of work, and this demand for rented office spaces and workspace provider. IWG has certainly seen a demand for more of these rented office spaces. Joining us now is Mark Dixon, IWG founder and CEO. Mark, great to have you on the program. And we keep hearing about hybrid work and more folks kind of wanting the ability to go into a rented office situation. Kind of shed some light on this. What are you seeing in terms of demand?
Well, we're seeing a big increase in demand. We've seen it actually throughout the pandemic period, and it's as the United States and other countries around the world come out of the pandemic, we're seeing continued demand as more and more companies move to a more hybrid way of working. That is allowing people to work some of the time from home, some of the time from a local office, and come into a central office some of the time. And that's been adopted by a lot of companies. And it's certainly in demand from people that work for companies who want to have more flexibility.
How does that change things for you, though, when it comes to trying to make sure you have tenants at all times, if that's the kind of the coming and going situation, as well as, you know, still obviously fears around Delta and COVID right now and kind of offices pushing back their return to having workers commingle?
Yeah, well, we are super flexible. We don't really have tenants. You sort of take our space the same way as you take an Uber cab. You get it on your iPhone or your smartphone, and you can book space for a day, a month, a year, almost anywhere. We're in 120 countries. We're all across the United States, for example. So we provide a level of flexibility that you just can't get in the normal real estate market. And that's what companies and people are looking for. They're looking for a different way of working in a sort of modern IT-enabled world where, you know, you can communicate with anyone anywhere, you can do your job from just about anywhere, and your office really lives with Google or lives with Microsoft. So it's a different world, and we really play into that. And that's why we've seen such an increase in demand over the past 3-4 months as people have started to change the way that they want to operate their companies.
Right. I feel like you're seeing more companies kind of embrace this remote first work style. And, you know, people do want to get out of their apartments or their homes and not necessarily be there, but have like the ability to have like an office thing. So I want to explore this with you. Are you seeing it more from individuals who want to rent, you know, maybe a little cubicle or conference room? Or are you seeing it from like, you know, companies, let's come together in this city. We're all here. There's a small group of us. Let's rent this space and do something. What's the breakdown you're seeing?
We're seeing it coming from both sides, in fact. So we've signed nearly 2 million people in the first half of this year. And these are companies like NTT, signed up 300,000 people, Standard Chartered Bank, 95,000 people. So very large companies that are implementing it for their people. They're saying, we want to allow flexible work for our workforce. We think it's what they want. And we're also seeing individuals, a lot of freelancers, a lot of smaller companies that are saying, look, it just makes sense to allow our people to work from wherever it's convenient. And that is not always from home. We also see many companies just giving workers an allowance to go get an office down the road from where they live. So, you know, the big things that's changed is really the geography of work. And the change is the need to commute, to go to a central office every day to use a computer. That's what won't be there in a few years' time.
And Mark, I mean, when we talk about your guys' expansion also in Egypt now, but back here in the U.S., it does seem like, you know, needs vary from city to city. Workspaces, and particularly what they should look like, vary from city to city. But what are you seeing in terms of the hottest places for the services you offer and the ones that have been nailing it and delivering on the hybrid idea?
Well, that's a very interesting question, actually. So, look, it's changing all the time. But what we saw during the pandemic was a very high demand for locations in the countryside, suburban locations. Where we had a problem was in the downtowns, you know, downtowns that had a long commute. These locations presented problems for workers. They didn't want to come in. But the out-of-town, very, very popular. What we've seen in the past 3-4 months is the downtowns become a lot more attractive and a lot more customer movements into the downtowns. And this is a lot of companies sort of downsizing from fixed space to providing more hub space for their workers so that they can provide it closer to where they live. So, you know, quite a big change in the last 3-4 months as the US in particular has come back to work. When we're seeing the same thing in Europe and in Asia.
Mark Dixon, IWG founder and CEO. Appreciate you coming on here to chat with us, and congrats on the new expansion. We'll see how the hybrid situation plays out. As you know, younger workers are really leaning into that. Thanks again for the time.
In today's Startup Spotlight, we are talking about the fintech company Zilch, which is focused on buy now, pay later financing. Joining me is the CEO and founder, Philip Bellamont. Philip, good to have you here. And before we get into your latest funding round and your expansion plans, just want you to sort of set the stage for us. Tell us what Zilch does, how it does it, because I know you say you're creating a direct relationship with the consumer, not the retailer.
Thanks for having me, Alex. It's great to be here. And that's absolutely true. So, you know, what we've done that we feel is a bit different, and certainly our stakeholders and customers see as a differentiation here, is a lot of BNPL providers, you guys might know, and of course we all talk about and draw a lot of inspiration from, really take care of a retailer first and foremost, and as a consequence of that, add some value to the end consumer. With Zilch, we've decided to flip that on its head and really are more focusing on adding value to the end consumer first, and as a consequence of that, adding some great value to retailers. And so what we love about this is we forge a direct relationship with that end consumer. And obviously what's fantastic there is today we're offering, you know, Pay in 4 as a product. We recently launched our new product, Pay in 1 with Cashback. And over time, we're obviously listening to what our customers want, and we can build any new product that they're looking for in 2 weeks, ship it for a dime to every customer we have, and they could use it at any retailer in the world instantly. Now, that's quite different when you consider traditional buy now, pay later providers who are really merchant acquiring companies, and in a lot of cases have to go and actually speak with retailers and understand if those retailers are willing to switch those products on. So for us, we really think this is a great way to go about sort of buy now, pay later 2.0, which is what we're excited about.
So when you talk about the others and competition, I mean, do you see your rivals as being Square, which just recently bought Afterpay? Who's in the space with you that's closely related?
You know, we take a lot of inspiration from, I would say, really three providers in the space. You know, we think Klarna is a great company. You know, we think Affirm is a great company. And obviously, we think Afterpay, which is now part of Square, as you mentioned, is a great business. And so, you know, I would say really those are the three that we take a lot of inspiration from. But what we're quite excited about, you know, from our stance is that we're a relatively new business. And, you know, thankfully, hindsight is 2020. So, you know, some of these incumbents are now 15, 16 years old. And I'm sure they're sitting around with their teams every so often saying, wow, well, you know, we could have used this tech, or if we had built this business more recently, we could have perhaps looked at this regulation or done something a little different. And that's the advantage we have as Zilch, you know, really today, is that we're building a business using the latest leading edge technology and, of course, the latest regulatory frameworks as well, to really build something quite differentiated. So I would say those are kind of in the market when you look at some comps. But, you know, really we have quite a unique business in that we don't lend money to retailers' customers. We actually bring customers to retailers and then offer them the opportunity to defer payment in the most responsible way. So those are where the market sees us as a comp. But, you know, we would argue that we're quite unique to these businesses even so.
And you may be young, but you just made your first U.S. acquisition with Netfin. Tell us the thinking behind buying up that company and also what you plan to do with the $110 million that you just closed on that funding round led by Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, we're really excited about that. You know, we've now raised just over $300 million, you know, kind of for the business right now. And a lot of that's going to go into the U.S. expansion. And so this Netfin acquisition of ours really does three things which we're excited about. The first is we're all about the customer first. And we're quite conscious and really aware of a lot of businesses that try to move to new markets and they don't bother to consider how the customer lives or wants to use a product in that market. And we really want to do a phenomenal job of building, you know, a U.S. product, an American product for Americans to use and love. That's really what we want to do. So with, you know, the leadership of Elle and Tom, our new CEO and COO out of Netfin in the U.S. now, these guys have seen the movie before. They've helped other companies from Europe come to the U.S., companies like Funding Circle. And so they've got great experience in doing this and actually seeing what's gone well and maybe what's not gone so well. And so we can learn from that and we can really apply that to our product. So that's the first thing. The second thing we're excited about on this acquisition is regulation. So, you know, Zilch is a company that really always puts regulation at the forefront of everything we do. And we have to do that because we're going direct to the customer. So we need to offer that customer the protections of regulation. And so, you know, what we really love about what Netfin had is they have a California lending license. They have a regulatory framework for lending throughout the whole of the states, and they're very close and understand how to do lending really well in the U.S. And so for us, you know, we feel that that's a massive advantage for us moving into the U.S., not just understanding state-by-state law, but federal law and how we're going to get this right and protect customers who use our service. And so finally, you know, really what does that all equal? That equals, you know, basically accelerated entry into the country, which is what we're really excited about. And we think this is going to speed up the entry by 6 to 9 months easily for us moving into the U.S.
Well, it's certainly a nice chunk of change. Zilch's CEO, Philip Bellomont, thanks so much for being with us.